The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. 2022 promises to be another massive year for Australian whiskey. And I'm sure that just like me, you want to know which are the hottest distilleries we should be looking out for. Luke McCarthy is founder of Oz Whiskey Review, an independent online magazine comprising Australian whiskey reviews, news and features. He's with us this episode to reflect on Oz Whiskey Review's top 10 Australian whiskies of last year and the biggest debut releases expected in the coming months. If you're new around these parts, most of the brands we discussed this episode have previously appeared on the show. Bakery Hill, Heartwood / Tasmanian Independent Bottlers, The Gospel, Starwood, Morris, Overeem, and Backwoods. Clearly the Oz Whiskey Review team have impeccable taste. So first up, I asked Luke about the criteria they follow in putting their list together.
The key criteria is that it's been released in that 12-month window. Other than that, we're looking at, basically the quality of the whiskey. So out-and-out quality of the whiskey, is it available as well? Obviously, for some of the single cask limited bottlings, they sell out pretty quickly. And the other metric that we sort of homed in on is affordability and sort of value for money generally as well. So look, there's some expensive whiskies there in our most recent list, but I think if you look at the age of those whiskies, the fact that, enough people were able to get around to them and purchase them too, that's one of our other metrics as well. Do consumers feel like they're getting value for that particular whiskey? So look, we try and keep it fairly light. It's not meant to be any sort of definitive list on the best whiskies of the last year. We just think it's a really good talking point, and it's great to get people thinking about what they were enjoying over the previous year.
And so I guess it's in no particular order. First up on the list is Bakery Hill Little French Pete Single Malt Whiskey. A 13-year-old from Bakery Hill. Pretty awesome just starting to see some of these bigger age statements coming through, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And that was a whiskey that I tried for the first time. I think I tried it blind, so I had no idea what it was. And this was a while ago, actually, when it was sort of still in its trial phase. And I was taken to distilleries like Hakushu in Japan. It had this sort of herbal, almost fragrant, minty sort of character to it, and very, very elegant. Great balance between spirit and cask too, which is, something that is a hot button issue in the Australian industry. So when they finally bottled it last year, I think that was roundly praised as probably one of the better whiskies anyone's tasted the last sort of 10, 20 years in the Australian whiskey industry. So an exceptional whiskey, and I think found a great audience too. So we were loving having that one there. But the single malt category is obviously very hotly contested. There could have been another 10 or 15 whiskies that could have easily taken its place.
That ended up being what you called your single malt of the year, is that correct?
Yeah, that was our top single malt of the year. We just thought, for utter complexity. I thought it was actually fairly well priced. Yes, it's an expensive whiskey, but it's spent a lot of time in barrel, and there's not a lot of liquid left in an Australian barrel once it's getting up to that 13, 14, 15 year period. So it's a cracking whiskey, that one.
Now, changing tack a little bit, The Gospel, fellow Melburnians with their wheated rye whiskey. I haven't actually tried that one. Tell me what the wheat brought to The Gospel's taste profile.
Yeah, so that was a really interesting mash bill to play with. So 60% rye and 40% wheat. Wheat is a grain that I'd love to see more Australian distillers using. We are an enormous producer of wheat, one of the top producing wheat countries in the world, and there are huge flavour opportunities to be explored with wheat. Yes, it's not the most flavourful grain going around, but it can just be used so well to balance out, other really big and intense flavours. That's what these guys did so successfully with their little limited release for the projects. Their rye grain that they use, a very particular rye grain from the Mallee there, it's just big and powerful, and you've got all sorts of crazy flavours to it, and I just think it was supported so well by the wheat. And again, the maturation there just didn't get in the way of the mash bill. And again, that's something that we were loving tasting last year. So, you know, maturation that supported the spirit rather than really tried to dominate it. And that was another great example of that, I think. Yeah.
Now, I think you've called out Morris as being the most significant whiskey launch of the year. And I'd totally agree with you on that based on the sort of scale they bring to the market and the quality of their debut whiskies. And I'm also with you on the Musket Barrels being my preferred release of the two. I know a lot of people actually preferred the Signature or whatever the lower tier release was.
Yeah, that's it. The Signature is it. So I think we had a bit of an argument and debate about what we preferred. I almost leaned personally towards the Signature just because I think when we were talking about, you know, balance between spirit and cask, I think the Signature, you know, did something that a lot of Australian whiskies haven't done in a long time. And it was probably a spirit forward flagship release, which is really uncommon. There's hardly any other Australian distillery that's sort of looking at that. But, you know, you really got the spirit first, I think, when you tasted the Signature. And then the cask was just there as a bit of a supporting character, even though, you know, they're using, you know, some ex-wine casks in there. So that for me was really interesting. But I think, you know, for pure heritage and complexity, then the Morris Musket was pretty hard to go past. It was such a great expression of what they do there at Morris. I was lucky to visit there over the Christmas period, actually. And I'm incredibly excited about what they're doing now and what they've got coming because, you know, it's just an area of the whiskey industry. And I was having a chat about Morris last night with some people at a bar. And they were talking about some Scottish friends that they'd encountered years ago and how, well, these Scottish friends were actually quite high up in the whiskey industry and they were very annoyed at the upstart Aussies with their access to these casks and thinking they can do things with, you know, ex-wine casks and ex-fortified casks in the way that we can. So, it's an aspect of the industry that's just going to grow and get more complex. And I think, Morris have shown what can be done in that space.
And it's just great to sort of have a player that's got the capital to be able to invest in the expertise and take the time to get it perfect because there's obviously a lot of startups that don't have that luxury that are much smaller.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that stood out to me as, you know, someone in the publishing and media space too. I thought the way they released it was fantastic. It was really clear. Just the two bottlings as well, which I think, again, is a great thing. Sometimes I think we occasionally see Australian distillers come out with four, five or six initial releases and it can just get a little bit confusing to figure out what their signature is and, you know, what they're trying to tell the consumer. So, yeah, from that side of things as well, I think they did a really good job.
Now, Florio's the Jabberwocky. Tell me about that one. I'm familiar with the distillery but don't know anything about this particular release.
Yeah, the Jabberwocky was an interesting one. It was, a real sort of masterstroke from Gareth and Angela Andrews putting together some barrel ends. So when they were bottling casks of whiskey, occasionally they'd have some whiskey left over. And they've been doing this for a while now where they just marry that up and try to introduce some different flavors and try to, I suppose, minimize the intense flavors they get with some casks. I think it was a really creative and interesting blending exercise between their casks. And, you know, the result was fantastic. It was a little bit savory. It was, you know, rich and sweet. And then it had this, you know, real oomph from some of the peated components that they produced there as well. So, incredibly complex. We had a blind tasting with that particular whiskey recently, just this week, against the Scottish whiskey. And it held up really, really well and made a lot of people think closely about the potential of peated whiskey here in Australia. And, you know, that isn't the only whiskey in that space here. There's other peated malts that are doing a really good job there too.
Furno out of Tasmania is the one that is the least familiar to me. I don't really know anything about those guys.
Yeah, so that's a perfect lead-in from our previous discussion there. So, we often describe Furno at Oz Whiskey Review as probably one of Australia's most ambitious peated whiskey projects. And, you know, I think it can hold that title really safely because, you know, it was basically inspired by Laphroaig, by Islay, by some of the most distinctive malts that you have coming out of Scotland. And what they're trying to do there is really capture that really peated island style. And they're doing that by using peat that's, you know, from the Flinders Island there. They're exploring different ways of injecting that peat into the malt. So they've got a couple of different processes that they've been using and working on, sort of the Lark post-malt smoking method. I know it gets a little bit convoluted, but they've been exploring that and trying to, smoke their malt in that way. And I think the results have been fantastic. I think the cask maturation that they've developed there too has been spot on. So some Australian flavours coming through from the Apera and Tawny cask that they're using, but then this injection of you know, Tasmanian peat into the equation too. So it's giving consumers as well, I think, a chance to taste the difference between peat from different parts of the country. You know, it's a very massive country, and the unique flora and fauna that makes up peat from different parts of the place is going to affect how the whiskey tastes, and that's what those guys are doing so well, and one of the reasons why we really, really love that project.
Overeem 12-year-old, another big age statement from, you know, one of Australia's most celebrated distilleries.
Definitely, yeah. And again, we're seeing bourbon casks used to great effect. I think the use of bourbon casks in Australia is just one of those really interesting parts of the industry, right? You can tell a lot of producers are hesitant to use them because maybe they think that, you know, you're not getting that distinctively Australian flavour in the whiskey that you're producing. But, you know, there's a lot of people within the industry that love to see more bourbon casks used and used in the way that Overeem has, where you're just allowing the spirit to gently mellow with the oak over time and, you know, maintain some integrity. You know, that spirit is allowed to sing and shine and to you know, be there, probably right there in the final palate experience. And, you know, hats off to the Overeem team for securing those casks and for having the foresight to think about, you know, what does a 10-plus, 15-plus Tasmanian single malt look like and taste like? And I think, the release of that whiskey was heralded by a lot of people in Tassie and beyond. It was a really great whiskey.
And some pretty high praise from Tasmania, from TIB, Tasmanian Independent Bottlers, the side label of Heartwood. And this particular one was the blend, a Molten Oat whiskey.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was an absolute cracker. So this is Tim Duckett, and I think it was actually his son, Louis, who was most responsible for putting this one together. So, you know, you have different cask components, different spirit styles, some peated components, and then they also throw in some oat whiskey there from Peter Bignell. So, you know, the fact that he was able to integrate such, you know, diverse components into what I thought was an absolutely cracking whiskey. I think Ev Leong, our resident reviewer, put that through its paces through the year, and she was astounded by it, as were a lot of other people. The price for it was incredible. And I think, you know, it was probably a genuine step forward in terms of what whiskey, you know, what you can do with blending whiskey and independently bottling whiskey here in Australia. So, yeah, an absolute cracker. And I think there's still some of that available. I'd highly encourage people to get on that and have a try of it. It's a cracking whiskey.
Now, I think the sole West Australian whiskey is Hungarian Oak by Whippersnapper. Now, is this a corn whiskey?
Yeah, it's a predominantly corn whiskey. It's very similar in style to a bourbon. The Hungarian Oak treatment there was one of two. They also finished off one of their whiskies, well, solely matured one of their whiskies in some French oak too. So, you know, he was seeing the Whippersnapper guys, massive proponents of, you know, basically bourbon-style corn whiskey from Perth there, just exploring different cask styles and options to create a bit more flavour in their whiskies. And the whiskies they've put out over the last 3 or 4 years have just been, yeah, broadly exceptional. Their wheat whiskey as well is unbelievably good. I can't speak more highly of it. So absolutely love what those guys are doing. And, look out for them in future. They're creating some really, really fantastic stuff.
Another one from Victoria, Kinglake. I haven't actually had a chance to try the whiskies as yet, but a lot of people, just as yourself, really seem to rate them highly.
Definitely. I think what I love about them is they're using malts from Voyager. So you've got some unique malts in the profile there. So it's not just a pale malt sort of mash that they're starting with. And so you're getting some big flavours from those malts and that spirit generally. And I think, again, really intelligently, they've matured a lot of their spirit in ex-bourbon casks. So huge flavour, huge complexity coming through from you know, the malt profile itself. But again, just allowing that to sort of mellow and sing in a less active, less forward cask. Price of that whiskey was absolutely exceptional as well. And we really love their pricing and commend them on that. You know, their O'Grady stand comes in, you know, under 100. And, you know, their limited bottling's a little bit north of that. So, probably I think for a lot of people, maybe a bit of a sign of where some new emerging distilleries might be heading in terms of price and flavour and style. So, a fantastic release from those guys.
One trend that we definitely saw last year was the interest of overseas independent bottlers in Australian whiskies. And you've picked one of them here at Delphi Selection, which was a 5-year-old Starwood single malt. Tell us about the independent bottling trend and this whiskey in particular.
Yeah, it was a huge year for that. As we sort of stated in the article there, we thought it was probably one of the biggest stories of the year, the fact that now independent bottlers, and we're not just talking, you know, the old independent bottler, we're talking about some of the best independent bottlers in the world, and, you know, people like the Scotch Malt Whisky Society, Adelphi, Barry Brothers and Rudd, that particular whiskey company. So, you know, these are some of the biggest players in that space, the people who probably do it better than almost anyone else. And they're now looking intensely and closely at Australian whiskey and then trying to bottle up the best expressions that they can find of it. So that Boutiques Australia series was right there in our thinking in that particular space as well. The Australia series for me was one of the most exciting things I tasted all year. I think that was absolutely incredible. Great job done by the team there. And then SMWS releasing their first whiskey, the Archie Rose single malt, which again for us was right there. For us, the Adelphi bottling just pipped it in terms of out-and-out complexity. We just love the patience that the Adelphi team showed in bottling that too. So it was, you know, it was probably taken out of barrel years ago, and they just allowed it to sort of sit and mellow and further mature, which is pretty odd. Lots of talk to the guys about the decision behind that, but I've got to meet the Adelphi guys on multiple occasions, and, you know, they're just a great example of patience and taking your time and waiting for things to be, you know, to hit their optimal point. And that for me was a great example of that. And yeah, who knows how far the international independent bottling of Australian whiskey is going to continue to go in the future. I know there's a lot of people now looking at, you know, getting their hands on whiskey and casks from Australia and bottling them overseas. So yeah, watch that space.
Now, I apologise here for my parochialism, but I'm just noticing there's not one New South Wales whiskey in the top 10.
There are some amazing New South Wales producers doing great things. I think at the moment, you've got to remember as well, most New South Wales malt whiskey distilleries are pretty new. I mean, Archie Rose only started releasing whiskey 2-3 years ago. So compared to some of the elder statesmen of the Australian whiskey scene, you know, they've got some pretty hefty competition, and often you'd see Archie Rose in the conversation there. We had them in our top 10 last year. I didn't think Archie Rose's limited releases were perhaps as complex and as well done as what they put out the year before. The Archie Rose Heritage Rye, San Diego Heritage Rye, I thought was an amazing whiskey, which came out in 2020. And so, yeah, look, there's plenty going on at Archie Rose, as I'm sure you know. There's huge transformations going in their new distilling space at the Banks Meadow site there. So, look, I'm sure they're going to bounce back quickly. But, you know, I'd also shout out to distilleries like Joadja, south of Sydney, who are doing some really good stuff. The Craftworks guys are also right there. And then you've got Dan Woolley up further the coast, who's released some fantastic whiskies, independent bottlings, and now his own whiskey, you know, coming out too. So there's plenty of people there in the New South Wales space. Next year, or maybe this year, we might see a few of them emerge in the top 10.
You're a fan of Backwoods Red Gum Cask whiskey. Have you tried many whiskies that have been finished in Red Gum casks? Well, actually, this is not finished in Red Gum cask. It's fully matured in Red Gum, isn't it?
Yeah. So I've tried to get my I tried to get my lips around nearly all of the whiskies that have played around with the native wood space. And I've come across quite a few of them. We reviewed one of the Stringy Bark releases from Derwent Distilling Co. last year, and then obviously the Backwoods Red Gum. And we also put in the Redlands Red Gum cask, which was, so far as we know, and there's some historical bottlings that from way back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, which might have pipped the current renaissance of Red Gum matured whiskies. But yeah, as far as we know, probably the Redlands bottling was the first one that came out. And having tasted a few of them, I think the Backwoods bottlings were incredible. I've actually tasted them and gone back to them a lot. They're very complex. They're divisive. And talking to the guys at the cellar door there, they pour them out obviously for people all the time, and they get very, very different results and reactions. Some people love them. Some people, you know, really don't warm to them whatsoever. What I think they did really well is thought very intelligently about how that red gum is treated. And it was a real process to get those red gum casks, you know, cooped into the barrels that they were after. Very old wood. We're talking about wood that's probably been seasoned for, you know, 5 or 6 decades. So this is a very long process to put a red gum matured whiskey in your glass.
So what had it been seasoned with previously?
So the wood actually came from a cooperage in South Australia, and it was initially intended to be used for a different purpose. And it had been sitting air drying in a cooper's shed for, those guys know, for about 5 or 6 decades. So the thinking there is that, in air drying the wood, you just take out a lot of the active components that might end up, in a spirit that subsequently matured in them. So that's what the Backwood guys were able to achieve there. It's a fully matured cask. So you're going to get, and you do get a lot of that flavor coming through, but it was just slightly tempered. It wasn't as aggressive as some of the other red gum matured whiskies that I've come across. So look, it's a fascinating part of the industry. And look, I know there are some people, particularly in the Scottish industry and fans of Scottish whiskey here in Australia, who are pretty dead set against it and think it's going to create awful whiskey. So I'm fascinated to see, where people can take it, that's for sure.
And the critics who've actually tried it and complain about red gum whiskies on that basis, what are the sort of characters that might potentially put people off?
I mean, the flavours that are there, you do get big, meaty, aggressive, woody notes coming through. There's hints of eucalyptus. There's a real minty sort of spearmint quality to some of them, not all of them as well. But then what I've found that's really exciting about them is they do have a fragrance to them, which is totally unique. It's an Australian fragrance. There are notes there that, you can't get in whiskies from anywhere else. So that's the really exciting part of it. And I think if you can find the malt profile, which will marry up with those casks, then you're singing. And that's why we selected the rye as our top, because I just think the rye profile had enough kick and I suppose enough flavour in the spirit itself to sort of balance out and to match up against the red gum. So, look, it's a fascinating space. It'll be amazing to see what happens. We're a long way, I think, from seeing those whiskies commonly available. But, if people don't start and experiment now, then we're never going to get there.
Nice one. Well, while I got you there, just a couple of things I thought I'd touch on. Every sort of couple of years we hear about how someone's, miraculously figured out a way to rapid age whiskey. And there's been a couple of them in Australia that I've heard about in recent times, one of which is Goodradigbee. I'm not sure how I pronounced that.
Yeah, the pronunciation of it would either be Goodradigbee or Goodradigbee, I'm not sure. I feel awful that we're probably mispronouncing it right here. Yes, I have come across some of, I suppose you call them spirits, you can't call them whiskies. And I think the flavours involved there are really interesting. I think it probably showed to me, characters of a little bit of immaturity, and some of the woodier notes involved with those whiskies they were fascinating. I enjoyed tasting them. Whether or not they were completely integrated with the spirit, it was probably up for debate. And then you have Mountain Distilling, where, yes, I have tasted that, but I tasted it blind as a judge, so I couldn't remember specifically tasting that particular whiskey. But, it was entered into the Australian Distilled Spirits Awards, which I judged towards the end of last year. I find both of them interesting experiments. I think they're valid. I sometimes wonder what's the purpose of the experiment. If you're trying to compete with whiskies and if the price is significantly more or the same as a whiskey that's spent X amount of years and evaporated and the producer has had to, wear that loss, then I sometimes wonder what's the point of the experiment there. If it's about flavor creation and about trying to create something new and different, that, is outside of whiskey or that is even beyond whiskey, great. Then I guess that's pushing the conversation forward and asking really interesting questions of the industry. I've tried a lot of rapidly aged whiskies from different parts of the world. At no point have I tried a rapidly aged whiskey that I think is better than a traditionally matured whiskey. So that for me is part of the difficulty. If I don't really understand the exercise if we're not getting to a point where we're producing better whiskey, maybe for cheaper, or is it better value for money? I'm not really sure what the point of the exercise is often.
Yeah, sure. And, mate, coming up this year, are there any distilleries that you're aware of that are right on the cusp of bringing product to market that you're particularly excited about?
Yeah, there's plenty. So plenty of established distilleries, some that we've mentioned obviously they're in the top 10 and I think are going to continue to do great things. Looking forward to Cape Byron Distillery, producers of Brookies Gin and a whole bunch of other liqueurs and other products. I'm hoping they release their first single malt this year. That was a whiskey that Eddie worked on with Jim McEwen. I had came across some samples of that. I got to chat with Eddie about it a couple of years ago and taste some progress samples. And yeah, it was a beautiful whiskey, very tropical. And then it was matured in ex-bourbon casks. And I'm not sure if that's what the final release is going to look like, but that would be one that I'd have my eyes on. And if the socials are correct, that should be coming hopefully this year. Plenty of distilleries coming out of Tassie that will be releasing whiskey this year. I'm interested to see if Callington Mill puts out some of their own whiskies this year, their own distilled and matured whiskies. They've released a whole series of whiskies produced from different distilleries recently, but that's a distillery to watch in Tassie for sure. Very, very large distillery, well, by Tasmania standards, doing some interesting things. And then elsewhere, I'm constantly finding new distilleries cropping up in places like South Australia. So we're just about to talk about some whiskies that the Cut Hill guys have bottled up, whiskies that they've sourced, but they're also producing their own whiskies, which will probably be released very soon. The other one that's a smoky that maybe you should, listeners should if they're keen on something, finding something that's a bit different but also very traditional. The St. Agnes Distillery, makers of some really fantastic brandy, have laid down single malt whiskey many, many years ago now. They've been a bit sneaky about when it's going to be released. I'm hoping it's going to be soon because it's probably spent quite a bit of time in cask now. So that could be one to keep on your radar this year as well.
Awesome, mate. Well, I'll let you go. Oz Whiskey Review, maybe tell us about it.
Yeah, so Oz Whiskey Review was started in 2020 and we're trying to develop it into a very large and detailed resource on the Australian whiskey industry. So currently we only really look at whiskies that are produced in Australia and we have a very, well, big and extensive database of distilleries where we discuss the story of the distillery. We look at production stats and try to give you really up-to-date information on each distillery. And then underneath that, you'll have all the whiskies that we've reviewed from that particular distillery too. So a big part of what we do at Oz Whiskey Review is constantly trying to review as many Australian whiskies that are released. We've got a pretty experienced team that have been in and around that space for a long time. So we're constantly putting out reviews on new and upcoming whiskies and even rare and sort of heritage whiskies, you know, from 50, 60, sometimes 70 years ago that were bottled in Australian whiskey sort of previous life. And then we also have some fantastic historical articles too. We're really interested in diving into the history of Australian whiskey over the last 30 years, but then also over the last 160 years, which is a part of the industry that hasn't really been explored. So it's a work in progress and it's a site that we're constantly working on and trying to improve and trying to take account of all the fantastic things that are happening in the Australian whiskey space. So it's exciting times and hopefully a lot more work to be done on that.
Yeah, you've definitely done a great job of bringing to light some of that really interesting history of the likes of Corio and some of those early distilleries. And you've been in contact with a bloke who worked there. Charlie Leopoldo is his name, isn't it?
That's correct, yep.
And has had some coverage for his amazing collection of artifacts from Corio. Is there any news on what's happening with that collection? Because I know he's been trying to sell it.
That's correct. Yeah, there is some news. There's lots of news in and around that story. And as you can imagine, as you no doubt are aware, there's a lot of people that are interested in purchasing the collection. I've been lucky to now spend quite a bit of time with it. And what will happen over the next few weeks and months, I'm not entirely sure, but definitely I'm hoping to be able to talk more about what I've discovered in spending some more time with the collection. Things like early Australian whiskey history, more Corio whiskey, more information on Warren Hype Distillery, and some of the early malt whiskey distilleries that were kicking around in and around Victoria in the early 1900s. And then gin history too. Gin is something I haven't been writing about as much over the last 3 or 4 years, but I'd love to see some people write about Australian gin history in a more comprehensive way, because that collection actually gives you a bit of a starting point and a bit of a framework to really talk about the history of Australian gin and how it was produced and the distilleries that were involved going way back. So yeah, it's an incredible collection, and it's allowing myself and other people to dive into the history of Australian spirits, which is great.
All right. Well, thanks heaps, Luke. You've given people some great ideas on whiskies to go out and get their hands on.
Pleasure, mate. Thank you for having me. It was great to talk to you.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson. Like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.